to, and I'm on an important mission.
The red droid stared. Obviously, the excitement of capture and restraint had overrun the R2 unit's circuits. Still, he chose to respond in kind.
I'm R5-D4. No mission that I know of. My memory was wiped 4 years ago.
R2-D2 continued as if he hadn't heard.
I must be sold tomorrow. I have to escape this sandcrawler. The fate of the galaxy depends on it.
What a strange droid.
Is that why your pincer was deep in my access compartment?
He asked.
You were sabotaging your competition?
Yes. Please, the Rebellion needs your help.
The word rebellion triggered something. The phantom of a memory. An imprint on his circuits that no wipe could touch. Or maybe he was simply moved by R2-D2's sincerity. Whatever it was, he almost believed. But the superior programming of R2 units made them capable of deception in certain circumstances. Everyone knew that. He couldn't trust a single word the blue droid said.
Please,
R2-D2 said again. The red droid was not capable of deception, so he could only tell R2-D2 the truth.
If I don't escape this sandcrawler and find a new master soon, I will cease to function.
R2-D2 murmured sympathy, but then he said,
I already have a master, and if I don't find him, the galaxy is doomed.
Again, that strange tug on his memory banks. Something he couldn't quite process. A truth that lay just beyond his sensors. A couple of Jawas paused what they were doing to glance their way. R2-D2 had lost his chance at stealth.
I won't try to hurt you again,
R2-D2 said. And with that, he rolled away into the dark recesses of the hold. The little red droid didn't take any chances. He stayed powered up all night, on highest alert. Morning came, sending dim, dusty light through seams where doors and panels didn't quite fit together anymore. The crawler lurched to a stop, and the cargo bay opened to a blinding hot world. The little red droid quickly adjusted his photoreceptors to compensate. The Jawas gathered up a handful of their most presentable droids and herded them down the ramp onto hard-packed dirt. R5-D4 was second in line. The sleeker, more beautiful R2 unit right behind him. The little red droid had a single slim hope. Maybe this particular farm would be too poor to afford the other droid. Maybe, just maybe, they'd have to settle for him. At the bottom of the ramp, a middle-aged human male stood waiting, hands on his hips, eyes permanently squinted from sand and sun. His desert clothes and utility belt were shabby, but clean and well-mended. His beard was scant and gray, but neat and trimmed. Surely a man who took such pains would make a fine master. The red droid was certain of it. Behind the farmer lay a homestead. It wasn't much. An adobe hut, a few holes in the ground, and the tall spindly towers of several moisture evaporators. Compared with the giant rust bucket he'd been riding for 4 years, it seemed like heaven. Beside him, R2-D2 danced to get the farmer's attention. R5-D4 stood stoic and still, though his circuits were firing so rapidly that his internal temperature was rising dangerously. His series was known for excitability, for unreliability. He would prove their reputation wrong. He would remain calm, behaving like a perfect droid. The farmer strode toward him, robe billowing. A boy followed at his heels, slump-shouldered and sulky. He was barely emerged from the human adolescent stage, slender and tanned, hair blasted blonde by Tatooine's twin sons. The older man's dark eyes zeroed in on his photoreceptors, and with a lift of his chin, he said,
"Yeah, I'll take that red one."
R5-D4 almost blew his circuits. Had the farmer actually said that? Had R5 really been chosen?
The farmer continued down the line, dismissing R2-D2 with a wave.
No, not that one.
He had chosen him. R5 couldn't believe his luck. It was all he could do to stay calm, to keep from rocking in place as the slender boy crouched before him to inspect his joints.
The farmer was interviewing the golden droid now, but R5-D4 hardly paid attention.
After 4 long years, he finally had a new master. This farmer and boy were going to be so glad they bought him. He would be the best droid they'd ever...
Beside him, R2-D2 loosed a mournful sigh.
"You'll find a master,"
R5-D4 assured him in binary.
"Someone will buy you,"
R2-D2 replied.
"There's no time."
"Luke,"
the farmer called. He indicated R5-D4 and the tall golden droid.
"Take these two over to the garage, will you? I want them cleaned up before dinner."
"But I was going into Tashi Station to pick up some power converters."
"You can waste time with your friends when your chores are done," the farmer said. "Now come on, get to it."
The boy sighed. "All right, come on." He gestured at the golden droid to follow him toward the farm.
"And the red one, come on."
R2-D2 chirruped sadly.
"The galaxy is doomed."
R5-D4 hesitated. He had a bad feeling. The boy realized the little red droid wasn't following.
"Well, come on, Red, let's go."
R5 shook himself into action and lurched after the boy. He was going to get cleaned up by his new master, no less. He'd been waiting for this moment for 4 years. Behind him, R2-D2 danced wildly in place.
"Help me, R5! You're my only hope!"
R5-D4 swiveled his head toward R2-D2, just in time to watch a Jawa lift a control box and zap the blue droid. The restraining bolt did its work, and R2-D2 went silent and still. The bad feeling intensified. The boy and the golden droid continued toward the farm. R5-D4 followed, but he crept along, his movements weighted by uncertainty. His circuits were firing so rapidly now, his internal processors churning and churning, trying to tell him something. Understanding hit him like a suction magnet. He believed. He believed R2-D2 was on an important mission. He believed the droid was out to save the galaxy. And something inside him, an imprint, a phantom memory, something as old and stubborn as the stars, insisted that he help. Because the cause of the rebellion was his mission too. He knew what he had to do. For the first time in 4 years of awareness, he would execute a deception. As a mere R5 unit, he shouldn't have been able to. But in the split second it took to formulate a plan, he discovered no barriers, no limits. He had been altered. No time to dwell on it now. He had to do an emergency energy purge, one that would take finesse and concentration. He prepared with care, shutting down unnecessary circuitry, loosening the hinge of his headplate. All that beautiful, precious lubricant the Jawa gave him the night before was circulating through his joints, calming his wires, cooling his circuits. He redirected its flow, collecting it into a mass just behind his photoreceptors. It would take every bit to be convincing. Once ready, the little red droid did not hesitate. He diverted power and discharged it all with a single devastating blow. His headplate popped off, showering sparks. Smoke poured out. the superheated lubricant making it as thick and grimy as a storm cloud. The boy whirled at the sound.
Uncle Owen!
He called.
Yeah?
The farmer said.
This R2 unit has a bad motivator. Look!
R5-D4 willed himself to utter stillness. Smoke continued to pour from his head, and a tiny drop of precious lubricant slipped down his casing. The farmer turned on the Jawas.
What are you trying to push on us?
He asked, arms flailing. R2-D2 recovered from his restraining zap and whistled low and clear, trying to get someone's attention. When that didn't work, he danced in place, babbling loudly. Please notice, R2, the red droid pleaded silently. It was the tall droid, with the annoying voice, who came to their rescue. He tapped a golden finger on the boy's shoulder.
Excuse me, sir, but that R2 unit is in prime condition. A real bargain.
The boy looked at R2-D2 as if seeing him for the first time.
Uncle Owen!
He called.
Yeah?
What about that one?
The boy indicated the blue droid. One glance was all it took.
What about that blue one?
The farmer asked the Jawas.
We'll take that one.
Oh,
a Jawa gave R2-D2 a nudge, and the silver droid scooted forward with a cry of victory. Another group surrounded R5-D4.
Yeah, take it away,
the boy said, waving smoke out of his face. The red droid had damaged himself badly, but he could still function. He powered down everything but his auditory receptors and played dead, allowing the Jawas to lift him and carry him back toward the dark, horrible sandcrawler. In low power, surrounded by Jawa bodies, he could barely make out R2-D2's twittering farewell.
Thank you, friend,
the little blue droid called to him.
You may have saved the galaxy today. I will never forget you.
R2-D2's story was confirmed when the Imperial stormtroopers came. The little red droid hunkered down in his nest of scrap, continuing to play dead, while troopers interrogated the Jawas about the two droids they just sold. Afterward, lasers blasted anything that moved, filling the sandcrawler with screams, turning the air damp and hot. The stormtroopers left the crawler a smoking ruin, littered with bodies. When he was certain the Imperials were gone for good, R5-D4 extricated himself from his nest, depressed the ramp control, and rolled into the hot desert sunshine. After 4 years with the Jawas, their trade route was as familiar to him as his own circuitry, and he knew exactly which way to go. One of the moisture farms in the next valley would gladly take a free droid. He would be repaired, cleaned up, made useful. Later, if he was lucky, he might even find the rebellion. He would have to hurry, because his damage was critical. But he had no regrets, and he did not look back. R5-D4 was barely a mote on the barren ochre landscape as he rolled toward the horizon, free and full of hope.
Rights by John Jackson Miller. The brain of a crate dragon occupied only a small portion of its massive skull. The rest of the space, according to Tusken lore, was storage for pure, unadulterated hate, a gift from one of the Sky Brothers far above. Akoba had thought that just one more foolish tale meant to frighten children and those too feeble to hold a weapon. But facing down the crate in the Box Canyon in the Jundlin Wastes, the burly young warrior could understand how the legend had gotten started. 4 times the Tusken had plunged the flanged point of his Gaddurfi into the juvenile dragon's head. 4 times he had missed anything vital, unleashing instead a torrent of teeth-gnashing, foot-stomping rage. There was no magic to it, of course. Any creature would react similarly to holes being poked in its head. He simply had to keep punching, presuming he could avoid being trampled.
"Hurry, cousin,"
called out another cloth-wrapped warrior. Clinging crazily to the beast's tail, Eivor had already lost his weapon in the dust, and his twin brother was somewhere back there too, having been thrown aside by the mighty crate. Among Tuscan clans, it was said the birth of twins was a poor omen. Whoever had come up with that one had definitely met his cousins. It was up to Akoba to keep his foolish kin alive. With a booming war cry, he charged the stomping mammoth, sidestepping its advance only at the last instant. He caught the side of the dragon's mouth with the trang, the bent end of his weapon, hooking the creature. It bit down instinctively. Such a bite would be enough to finish almost anything the crate would encounter. But this meal was not bone, but Durasteel, scavenged by the tribe from some old settlement. The hefty weapon's tip was doused with sand bat venom, and at the taste of that fast-acting paralytic, the dragon stumbled sideways in confusion. Akoba hung on to the shaft of the Gaderfi, forcing the weapon farther into the monster's maw. The crate collapsed, narrowly missing him and kicking up a shower of sand as it struck the surface. Akoba wrested the weapon free from its mouth and climbed its scaled head. This time, it did not react to his repeated stabs. The deed was done. "Yes!" Eivor called out, in the braying tongue of the Tuscans, releasing his clench on the dragon's tail.
"We are adults now!"
"I am. I don't know about you two."
Akoba looked back to see Eivor's brother clambering through the sand toward them, injured but not broken. Before he could chide them for their performance, he spied the watchers from the clan descending from the ridge onto the battleground. He dislodged his Gaderfi from the crate's brain and raised it into the air.
"I am Akoba!"
he shouted, standing proudly on the corpse's giant head.
"I have slain a crate dragon. I am a Tuscan."
"You have slain a hatchling in the heat of day," said one of the newcomers. "Do not think you are a warrior of legend."
"Who?"
He looked down, where a glint of light reflected from the setting suns told Akoba exactly who had spoken. A Yark. Where other Tuscans had two metal turrets for eyepieces, the chief of the clan only needed one, and had long ago jammed a crimson jewel into the useless right eye. It plugged the hole, true, but it also reminded everyone who was in charge.
"Come down from there,"
A Yark said.
"Looking up at you itches my neck."
Akoba thought of five things to say, banished them all as unwise, and complied. The shambling twin brothers assembled nearby.
"We did meet the challenge,"
Eivor said.
"Yes, yes."
Ayark turned to where a companion held the twins' errant weapons.
"Our law says whoever has two hands can hold a Gaderfi. I am not sure what it makes of warriors who keep dropping them."
The brothers shrank back in shame, but Akoba did not withdraw.
"It was no small victory, Ayark."
He gestured to the corpse.
"A canyon crate, the largest hatchling of its clan."
"And should its parents find you, you will be the flattest of ours."
Ayark's head shook.
"I will kill its whole family,"
Akoba said, clenching his cloth-wrapped fist.
"You will see. I will lead the clan in battle one day."
"So you have told us all."
Ayark stepped past and evaluated the crate.
"I admit it is a worthy feat. When I became chief long ago, the clan had been brought so low, our younglings were forced to kill Logra in the rites of adulthood."
"And womp rats and sand beetles."
At the moment of his triumph, Akoba was in no mood for another lecture on how Ayark's chieftaincy had saved the clan.
I meant what I said, he declared. I fear nothing. Send me, and I will lead a hunt tonight.
Ayark looked back abruptly.
Only a fool fears nothing.
Then either I am a fool, or you are wrong.
Akova stalked around the corpse, making a show for the others.
What should I fear? Surely not the settlers and their machines. And I know not to walk near a sarlacc.
He pointed to the north.
Or do you mean the hut? Let him spend a day out here on the wastes beneath the suns. He will shrivel down to the wart he really is.
The line amused his cousins. Amphibian warts were an odd thing to find on a desert planet, but most Tuscan younglings had clubbed at least a few of the squat creatures to death. Ayark, however, was neither entertained nor deterred.
You speak only of the obvious threats, the chieftain said. But there are magics in the desert. I have lived long and seen great powers at work, wielded by beings beyond our ken.
I have had my dinner and need no story.
Akoba gestured back toward the hills.
I am sure there are children back at the camp to scare.
Ayark grabbed his shoulder firmly.
It takes more than courage to lead. It takes eyes that are open.
And I have one more than you. You leap at gusts of wind, Ayark,
Akoba snorted, and then caught himself. He stepped back and made his respects.
I fear only you, my chieftain.
That is a start.
Ayark's jewel caught the light from the setting suns.
Claim your bantha and lead your hunt. But before you strike at anything, report back to me.
The chieftain waved dismissively at the twins.
And if these two lose their Gaderfi in the dark, lose them.
Ayark is the true fool,
he had told the brothers more than once on their overnight hunt. Akoba did not fear their wagging tongues. Open ambition was a feature of Tuscan life. No sand person would respect a quiet schemer. There was some security offered by his youth. He was so far from ready for a confrontation that Ayark would likely not take offense. Akoba had no idea how old the chieftain was, only that Ayark had held the role longer than anyone in memory. That, in another clan, would have suggested someone aged and in danger of being challenged. Not Ayark, who remained as fierce, if not fiercer, in battle as any warrior Akoba had seen. And yet somehow the chieftain had grown tentative, particularly when Akoba and the twins returned from their night's stalking. They had reported seeing a droid trundling along a valley along the southeastern limb of the Jundland, motoring along in darkness without evident care. Mechanical effigies made to talk, droids were one of the more puzzling features of settlers' lives. They were rarely of interest to the Tuscans, who usually neither knew nor cared what they had been built for. The tubby droid had one sure purpose, however. It made for excellent bait. Someone would come for it. And then Akoba would strike. If he was allowed to. It was Ayark again. The droid's trail passed not far from a place, the chieftain said, where an entire camp of Tuscans had been mysteriously massacred in the night, many cycles before. Most clans had avoided the ruins ever since, ascribing ill omens to the area. More nonsense. But Ayark took it seriously enough that the chieftain insisted on going along with the trio that morning to shadow the droid's trail. With banthas, in case they needed to move fast or carry spoils, and with blaster rifles.
Your superstition verges on cowardice,
Akoba thought, as he and Ayark watched the desert from a craggy outcrop. They had gone to a spot along the droid's path where the gorge zigged and zagged, offering multiple settings for an ambush. There were even safe places nearby to leave the banthas. But Ayark had made them take the long way around to reach the place, and the chieftain had stopped repeatedly to study their surroundings.
We have wasted much of the day,
Akoba said as they waited on a hillside and watched.
We could have been here long ago.
There is more to avoid here than you know. A great power, indeed. Beyond these mountains dwells...
I will not hear it, Akoba snapped. What could happen with the suns high above? I do not know what you are trying to...
Quiet!
Ayark yanked at Akoba's robe, but it was not to accost him. He heard a moment later what the chieftain had heard. The sound of an approaching engine. The two hustled to a promontory where they saw a land speeder, an infernal human machine zooming into the valley below.
This is it.
Raising his rifle, Akoba drew a bead on the distant vehicle as it raced from left to right, only to withdraw when Ayark touched his shoulder. The chieftain was correct about this, at least. The landspeeder was too far away, and if its occupants were coming for the droid, they would surely stop when they reached it. The warriors moved swiftly with their banthas to a ravine southeast of the last place they'd seen the droid. A narrow ridgeline separated them from their prey. Akoba could hear the engine of the landspeeder whine to a halt. Leaving the hairy beasts of burden behind, he and the twins began scaling the ridge. There was little time to lose. So when another hushed call came from over his shoulder, Akoba looked back in aggravation.
What is it, Ayark?
The one-eyed chieftain stood partway down the rise, rifle in hand, and gestured to the mountains to the north.
This place. I tried to tell you. It is near the lair of a powerful shaman.
A what?
A human, yet more than flesh,
Ayark said.
We have avoided this area too for years.
What have you not avoided, old fool?
Akoba looked up to where the twins had completed their ascent, and then called back to Ayark quietly.
He has militia, like the settlers?
He needs none. The creatures of the sands answer him.
Ayark paused in reflection.
No, the very air answers him.
Akoba stared, incredulous. Then he found his canteen and pitched it down the hillside.
You should stay here, my chieftain, and drink. The suns have gotten to you.
I tell you, I speak the truth.
The two watched as Eivor scrambled back down the incline.
The speeder did stop, he reported when he reached them. A human and another droid, this one a golden man.
Ayark looked up.
What does the human look like?
Hair the color of sand, young, I think, as we are, dressed as a farmer.
Akoba regarded his cousin and raised his hands to the chieftain.
You see... Not your wizard. Come on.
But Ayark stood transfixed, trying to work it out.
A farm child and his droids? All the way out here? Here. It does not augur well.
Akoba stared for a moment, then shrugged. He shook his head.
You disappoint me. Go down and remain with the banthas. We will bring the prizes to you.
Ayark responded with reluctance.
Go. Take. But do not kill unless you must.
Akoba turned back to face his cousin, and together they started scaling the rise.
A Tuscan chief scared of shadows and counseling mercy? Madness!
Perhaps, he thought, he might be making a challenge for leadership much sooner than he ever imagined. The twins threw Sandy Hare's limp body to the ground. It had been simply done moments earlier by Akoba, his first attack as an adult warrior. He had not killed, as he would have preferred, but he had disarmed the young farmer in an instant and had knocked the boy unconscious after filling him with abject terror. An auspicious start, Akoba thought, to a legend of his own. Perhaps doddering simps would speak his name in low tones one day. His partners had been forced to satisfy themselves with chopping the arm off the Golden Man, which in the listing of feats hardly counted.
"Where is this squat droid?"
Eivor asked.
"You wish another glorious kill?"
Akoba sneered.
"Forget it. Get to work."
Together, the three rifled through the materials on the landspeeder, searching for anything that might be of use. It was the raider's nature to look quickly, although there was definitely no rush. Out here, there was no rescue possible for the stricken traveler.
Nothing to worry about it.
The sound echoed through the gorge. Loud, terrible, and changing as it reverberated through the rocks. It could only have come from one thing.
A canyon crate,
Akoba thought. And not just any.
A queen.
The sound had come from the northeast. All three Tuscans looked in that direction simultaneously, fully expecting to see the vengeful parent of the beast they had slain the day before. That, in this place, would mean their deaths. Yet what they beheld was far more unexpected. A figure, cloaked in brown, face invisible beneath a pointed hood. A figure that in no world the Tuscans knew could ever make such a sound.
The shaman.
In the split second during which he processed that thought, Akoba was gripped by fear. In every measure, the same fear he had just struck into the farm boy. Images flashed through his mind. Akoba's limbs went into motion, turning him from his position by the hood of the landspeeder. His cousins were already on the move, fleeing. He rushed to follow. He was over the ridge when he dared to think again. What had he just seen and heard? Akoba had never clambered onto a bantha with two other warriors before, but that was what had happened. They had made for the nearest ride, and the war leader had followed on the other. Ayark caught up with the trio far from the gorge. The cousins were off their mount, huddled by a ridge and chattering to each other nervously. Akoba sat in the sand at the feet of the bantha, reins still clenched tightly in his hand. He barely noticed as the chieftain approached.
"I heard,"
Ayark said.
"I was already in the saddle."
Akoba said nothing.
"You fear,"
the chieftain said.
"Desert magic has not touched you before."
"I felt it."
Akoba did not look up.
"It was not just the sound. I felt..."
"In the presence of a mature crate."
"Come for vengeance, after the one I killed."
"And do dragons seek vengeance?"
Akoba struggled to process the thought. He looked up.
"This one did. I felt it in the sound. But when I looked, I saw that figure."
He stopped, worried he looked a fool. He had said too much, but he allowed one last thing.
"I did not trust my eyes."
Ayark stared at him and knelt.
"The settlers call him Ben."
"What? How do you know this?"
"All that live on the wastes I have seen,"
Ayark said.
"And I first saw Ben before your birth. He is an outlander, a wizard. He dwells at the edge of the Jundland."
Akoba heard but did not understand.
"If he is a danger, why did we not strike him before?"
"At what risk? It was better to yield this area. The desert is large, and I think he has nothing worth taking."
Ayark paused.
"We are taught that all who live are the Tuscans' enemies. But that may be too simple. There are things that will leave us alone if we do the same. A sarlacc will not come to visit your camp."
The chieftain stood. Akoba nodded, breathing normally again. Then the young warrior looked over to the cowering cousins, both shivering in the suns. Something did not sit right.
"No,"
Ekoba said at last, glancing at the skyline.
It cannot stop here. We must go back.
He stood. Ayark started with surprise.
Back? To the gorge?
Yes, in greater numbers.
He dusted himself off and looked to the chieftain.
This is our place, as hated as it is. We must show that no one may trespass with perfidy. Not even wizards.
Ayark regarded him with evident new respect.
If you would do this, then go. You have my sanction. I must decide for the whole clan, but you are an adult, Ekoba. Your life belongs to you, as do the lives of any who would join you.
Will I die?
If you are fated to. But you will be seen to die as a Tusken.
Ayark watched the trio vanish into the dunes in search of reinforcements, confident they had not the slightest chance of finding the wizard on their return. Life under the suns had changed Ben's appearance, but it had not stolen his senses. If Sandy Hare was someone the wizard cared about, Ben would waste no time in spiriting him and his droids away. So allowing Ekoba to give pursuit was a gesture, but not a wholly empty one. Ayark knew there were certain rites even a chieftain must perform. Ekoba's prize was already lost, but there was no sense in dispiriting him, not so soon after his reaching adulthood. So few warriors had his drive, and defiance was what separated killers from carrion in the Jundlan wastes. Ekoba had learned to fear this day. In leading his companions on a chase so soon after a scare, he would rise in their respect. A dual lesson, in a place where everything cast two shadows. Perhaps one day Ekoba, too, would use the example of the wizard in teaching others. Whenever that happened, Ayark suspected Ben would still be around. In earlier times, the chieftain had expected the sorcerer to leave, as most settlers with any wisdom eventually did. But he had remained, clinging tenaciously to the edge of existence, watching over this place or that. He seemed bound to the land, as the Tuskens were, and yet not like them. The Sand People lived under an ancient curse. Any higher power capable of shackling Ben to the desert lived today, wielding a might too frightening to consider. No, the wizard might escape, or he might be set free. But he would not simply disappear into the sands. Such beings did not die. They shaped the fates of countless many across the stars, in places no Tusken had ever conceived of. It was idle to wonder what Ben might do if he ever left. Ayark only knew what the Tuskens would do. They would raid. They would pillage. They would strike more places, areas once under the shaman's protection. Not because they coveted anything there, or hated Ben, or sought revenge, but because that was what they were. Indeed, that was all they were. And they weren't going anywhere.
Master and Apprentice by Claudia Gray. Some believe the desert to be barren. This proves only that they do not know the desert. Deep within the dunes dwell small insects that weave nets to trap one another, and burrowing snakes with scales the color of stones so that no hunter can find them. Seeds and spores from long-dead plants lie dormant in the warmth, waiting for the rainfall that comes once a year or decade or century, when they will burst into verdant life as brief as it is glorious. The heat of the sun sinks into the grains of sand until they glow, containing all the energy and possibility to become glass the color of jewels. All of these sing individual notes in the one great song of the wills. No place is barren of the Force, and they who are one with the Force can always find the possibility of life. Awareness precedes consciousness, The warmth is luxuriated in and drawn upon before the mind is cognizant of doing so. Next comes the illusion of linear time. Only then does a sense of individuality arise, a remembrance of what was and what is, a knowledge of oneself as separate from the Force. It provides a vantage point for experiencing the physical world in its complexity and ecstasy. But the pain of that separation is endurable, only because unity will come again, and soon. That fracture from the all, that memory of temporal existence, is most easily summed up with the word the fracture was once called by. The name. Qui-Gon. The name is spoken by another. Qui-Gon has been summoned. He draws upon his memories of himself and takes shape, reassembling the form he last had in life. It seems to him that he feels flesh wrap around bones, hair and skin over flesh, robes over skin. And then, as naturally to him, as though he had done so yesterday, he pulls down the hood of his Jedi cloak and looks upon his Padawan. Obi-Wan. It is worth the travail of individual existence just to say that name again. So he says the other name too. Ben. Obi-Wan Kenobi's hair has turned white. Lines have etched their traces along his forehead, around his blue eyes. He wears Jedi robes so worn and ragged as to be indistinguishable from the garb of the impoverished hermit he pretends to be. Most would walk past this man without a second glance. Yet while Qui-Gon perceives the physical realities of Obi-Wan's appearance, he is not limited to human sight any longer. He also sees the confident general of the Clone Wars, the strong young Padawan who followed his master into battle, even the rebellious little boy at the temple that no master was in any hurry to train. They are all equally part of Obi-Wan, each stage of his existence vivid in this moment.
You are afraid,
Qui-Gon says. He knows why. The events taking place around them are clearer to him than they are to Obi-Wan.
You seek your center. You need balance.
The living find it difficult not to tell the dead that which they already know. Obi-Wan doesn't even try.
There may be Imperial stormtroopers waiting for Luke at the Lars farm.
If so, then you will rescue him.
Qui-Gon smiles.
Or he may rescue himself. Or the sister will find the brother instead.
Obi-Wan cannot be so easily comforted.
Or he could be killed. Cut down while still hardly more than a boy.
To Qui-Gon, all human lives now seem impossibly brief. Years are irrelevant. It is journeys through the Force that matter. Some must struggle for that knowledge through many decades. Others are very nearly born with it. Most never begin the journey at all, no matter how long they live. But Luke Skywalker.
Luke has a great journey yet to go,
Qui-Gon says.
It does not end here.
You've seen this.
Qui-Gon nods. This relieves Obi-Wan more than it should, because he cannot guess the shape that journey will take. Their surroundings in the physical world become clearer. The endless dunes of Tatooine stretching out in every direction. A smoldering sandcrawler, a hulk behind them, a dozen tiny Jawas dead. The memory of their fear and helplessness lances Qui-Gon's consciousness, as does the meaninglessness of their deaths. Although Obi-Wan has been tending to the bodies, for the moment, the Jawas are seen to only by two droids. The droids comfort Qui-Gon somewhat because they are familiar. The Force has even seen fit to bring these two back to the place where it all began. Time is a circle. The beginning is the end. Obi-Wan murmurs.
Bail Organa sent Leia herself to summon me. When I saw her, saw Padme in her so strongly, and even a little of Anakin too, I knew my exile was nearly at an end. Would you believe I find it difficult to let it go?
You've adapted. You've had to. No wonder that the desert feels like home to you now, or that being a Jedi Knight has become foreign. But that can change, and faster than you might dream possible. It will in fact be almost instantaneous, a transformation begun and completed the first time immediate danger beckons again. Qui-Gon looks forward to witnessing it.
I've waited for this day for a very long time, Obi-Wan says. So long it feels as though I've waited for it my entire life. To have it endangered. Now, just as the great work begins, so many factors are in play. The future is difficult to know, even more so than before.
Do you truly think your work has only just begun, my Padawan? They have begun using that title between them again, in recognition of how much more Obi-Wan has yet to learn. It is strange still to think of death as only the beginning of wisdom. Obi-Wan considers,
there were other great endeavors, other challenges, but the Clone Wars were long ago. For nearly 2 decades, I have been little more than a shadow waiting to become a Jedi Knight again.
Qui-Gon shakes his head. Already his physical self feels natural enough to him that he can express thought and emotion through gestures. Battles and wars aren't the measure of a Jedi. Anyone can fight given a weapon and an enemy. Anyone can use a lightsaber, given due training or even good luck. But to stand and wait, to have so much patience and fortitude, that, Obi-Wan, is a greater achievement than you can know. Few could have accomplished it.
Fewer still could have done so without turning to darkness. Sometimes, when Qui-Gon considers it, he is awed by his student's steadfastness. Every person Obi-Wan ever truly loved, Anakin, Satine, Padme, and Qui-Gon himself, came to a terrible end. 3 of them died before his eyes. The other fell to a fate so bleak that death would have been a gift. The Jedi Order that provided the entire framework for Obi-Wan's life was consumed by betrayal and slaughter. Every step of this long, unfulfilling journey is one Obi-Wan had to take alone. And yet, he never faltered. As the rest of the galaxy burned, his path remained true. It is the kind of victory that most people never recognize, and yet the bedrock all goodness is built upon. Even Obi-Wan doesn't see it.
You see me in a kinder light than most would, old friend.
I owe you that. After all, I'm the one who failed you.
Failed me?
They have never spoken of this, not once in all Qui-Gon's journeys into the mortal realm to commune with him. This is primarily because Qui-Gon thought his mistakes so wretched, so obvious, that Obi-Wan had wanted to spare him any discussion of it. Yet here, too, he has failed to do his Padawan justice.
You weren't ready to be a Jedi Master, Qui-Gon admits. You hadn't even been knighted when I forced you to promise to train Anakin. Teaching a student so powerful, so old, so unused to our ways, that might have been beyond the reach of the greatest of us. To lay that burden at your feet, when you were hardly more than a boy.
Anakin became a Jedi Knight.
Obi-Wan interjects, a threat of steel in his voice.
He served valiantly in the Clone Wars. His fall to darkness was more his choice than anyone else's failure. Yes, I bear some responsibility. And perhaps you do too. But Anakin had the training and the wisdom to choose a better path. He did not.
All true. None of it any absolution for Qui-Gon's own mistakes. But it is Obi-Wan who needs guidance now. These things can be discussed another time, when they're beyond crude human language. Soon. Very soon. The droids have begun cremating the Jawa bodies. Qui-Gon is substantial enough now to smell the ash. But he is of the Force, and so he feels Luke's pain and horror as truly his own. The sight of the burned bodies of Owen and Beru Lars is as vivid as Obi-Wan standing only centimeters in front of him. Owen and Beru knew the risks when they took the child, and they took him anyway. took him, protected him, loved him. It is as pure a heroism as Qui-Gon has ever known. Obi-Wan senses it too. Qui-Gon can tell, though at a greater remove, handicapped as he is by his physical form. His face falls, his fear replaced by sorrow. Determination swiftly follows. I didn't tell Luke the whole truth about Anakin, Obi-Wan says. Someday he'll have to know. You've only just become acquainted with the boy. Had you tried to tell him the whole story today, that would have been a greater mistake than anything else you could have done. It would have planted seeds of doubt, confusion, even anger, which could have led him down his father's path. With a touch of his old rakish humor, Obi-Wan adds, or he would have decided I was every bit as crazy as Owen always told him I was, and run along back home. Qui-Gon knows that to have been a very real possibility, and the end to which that would have led. Luke would now be lying alongside the Larses. When he's ready, stable, steady, strong in the Force, then there will be time. Obi-Wan nods, enough reassured to focus fully on Qui-Gon. You're very nearly corporeal. I've never seen you appear like this. It's a matter of learning to both claim the physical world and detach oneself from it, Qui-Gon says. He had not struggled toward that goal at first. Only after Anakin's fall did he push himself to emerge fully. It was the work of very nearly a decade. This he did for Obi-Wan. At least his Padawan did not have to spend his years in the desert entirely alone. A matter of finding center, of calming one's soul, and giving oneself over completely to the Force. Some Jedi choose to transition between life and death in that way, though I could scarcely have imagined it when I was alive. Even after death, we continue to learn. I look forward to learning the art someday, Obi-Wan says, hopefully in the distant future. It's another of his dry jokes, nothing more, but Qui-Gon is moved regardless. Obi-Wan has so little time left to live. To Qui-Gon, the death seems inevitable, almost neutral. He can even anticipate the reunion with his Padawan. But after all his losses, all his sacrifice, all these endless years in the desert, Obi-Wan Kenobi still wants more life. This, too, is a kind of courage. Qui-Gon remembers the vitality of mortal existence, fondly but distantly. At least he has something better to offer Obi-Wan. Thank you, Qui-Gon, Obi-Wan says. As always, your wisdom sustains me. As your strength always sustained me. Qui-Gon senses the boy's return. Before long, Luke's landspeeder will appear on the horizon. Obi-Wan needs to turn his attention elsewhere. We shall meet again soon, my Padawan. I will never hesitate to call upon you. That's not the kind of meeting Qui-Gon means, but there's no point in saying so. The truth will unfold itself in time. It always does. Qui-Gon allows his awareness to spread outward from this place, until Obi-Wan is only part of the symphony of life around him. The snakes burrow deep beneath the dunes. Insects spin webs among the sand. Sunshine suffuses them all with warmth, until Qui-Gon can let go completely, releasing his body and even his name, until he is again one with the Force. As Obi-Wan will soon learn, the most beautiful form of mastery is the art of letting go.
Beru White Sun Lars by Meg Cabot.
It's not as if I wasn't expecting it. The day Ben Kenobi put that little baby in my arms was both the best and worst day of my life. Best because Owen and I couldn't have a child of our own. And suddenly we did. And worst because, well, I knew that happiness was never going to last. And I was right, wasn't I? Look, I get it. To most people, I'm just Luke Skywalker's Aunt Beru, the old lady who's always bustling around the kitchen, pouring everyone blue milk. I'm the one who wouldn't stop nagging Luke's Uncle Owen to let him go to the academy already. He can't stay here forever. Most of his friends have gone, I kept saying. It means so much to him. It wasn't because I wanted Luke to go. It's because that's what Luke wanted. And I wanted Luke to have whatever he wanted. And, okay, there might have been a small part of me that was hoping that if he went, things might turn out all right. Maybe if Owen had listened to me, we'd both be alive today, visiting Luke wherever he is now, spoiling his kids rotten, or watching the twin suns set here on Tatooine. But I guess we'll never know now. Look, I'm not complaining. My family's been in the moisture farming business for generations. I knew what I was getting into when I married Owen Lars. Or at least, I thought I did. Do you want to know a secret? I had other options. I took a cooking class in school, and the teacher told me that my blue milk cheese was the best he'd ever tasted. He said, it was as if I'd been born to make blue milk cheese. He said I could easily have had my own place, a cafe, or maybe even a little restaurant in Anchorhead. Could you imagine me, Beru White Sun Lars, with my own cafe? I won't lie to you. I thought about it, especially right before Luke came along, when Owen and I had just found out we'd never be able to have kids of our own. Our only resort was to start seeing one of those fancy fertility droids in Mos Eisley. It almost didn't seem worth it, though, when you considered what Mos Eisley was like back in those days. Oh, my stars, the noise and the dirt and all the violence. You could get shot just stepping into a cantina, let alone trying to serve a nice blue milk cheese to people there. Thanks to Luke, it never came to that. Still, there have been plenty of times I've wondered if I'd made a mistake. That day old Ben Kenobi showed up with the baby, my first instinct was to run. I may be a country girl who's never been off-planet, but even I'm aware that when a Jedi walks up to you and says, "Here, have a baby," it's not going to end well. A part of me thought, "Beru, listen to your teacher. Put the baby down and go do what you were born for." But it turns out when someone puts a sweet little newborn into your arms, you can't say no. Even if that baby is your husband's nephew by his stepbrother who's embraced the dark side. You know things may not turn out well. But just like with blue milk cheese, you do the best you can with it. And it turned out to be the best decision I ever made. Luke was such a sweet, happy little boy. He was no trouble at all. Not to say he wasn't mischievous, always getting into one scrape or another. But he didn't have a mean bone in his body, unlike a certain someone I could mention. All right, fine, I'll mention him. I mean his father. When you spend almost every minute of every day with someone for 19 years, making him finish his milk to help him grow and washing his leggings for him, you get to know that person. And like I told Owen, Luke had too much of his father in him. But I meant all the best parts, and his mother, too, from what little I knew of her. It was obvious to me from the time Luke was a baby that he was going to grow up to do something amazing. And I'm not just saying that because I was his aunt. I just knew. And I was right. I'm not trying to take credit for Luke's accomplishments either, although Owen and I did try to do our best with him. I always thought it was so sad what happened to Luke's parents, and his grandmother, too. I was there for her funeral. I served blue milk and cheese to everyone after. I think my teacher was wrong. Making cheese wasn't what I was born to do. I was born to make people feel good when everything around them seemed just awful. Which, if you think about it, is what all good parents and cafe owners are meant to do.